doing something totally different, like acting in a movie far from home, was just what I needed at the time. So I excitedly went to Texas. One day, I got back to the hotel after filming, and someone at the front desk told me that a package had been delivered for me, and that it was in my room. I get up to my room, and there's a huge box waiting for me, and it's from Yauk. It was the closest thing to a care package at sleepaway camp I'd ever received. I hurriedly opened it, and there was another huge box inside it, then another box inside of that one, then another. It kept going until there was a big Ziploc bag filled with coffee grounds. Inside all that mess was another Ziploc bag with a cassette tape. It was the demos from his band Brooklyn. Man, I miss him and the dumb and detailed stuff he'd do like that. I didn't think for a moment about being hurt that he was in another band and was having fun with other bandmates. It just made me so happy to have a friend that I loved so much go to crazy lengths to keep our friendship intact. After a few weeks in San Antonio, the production moved to L.A. I'd only really traveled places with Adam and Mike, and so this was new for me, being somewhere else on my own. I wasn't lonely, though, because luckily my sister Rachel happened to be in Los Angeles for a bit when I first got there. Before she left, she introduced me to someone who would be my first friend in L.A., Dono, Donovan Leach. We hit it off right away. It's that thing when you meet someone who grew up thousands of miles away from you, but you feel like you could have and should have been friends forever. You're into the same stuff, understand all the reference points, etc. Dono introduced me to his friends, and I quickly became part of their circle. One night, Dono took me to this crazy Hollywood party at the house of this big-time Hollywood manager, Sandy Gallen. It was me and Dono and a bunch of his friends, and it felt like I was with my friends back home, crashing a party at some weird rich person's house. But in the context and trajectory of our band, this party would turn out to be much more significant than that. Because it's L.A., we were hanging out by the swimming pool. Nighttime pool parties in Hollywood are exactly what they look like on TV. I bumped into this guy, Matt Dyke, who had put on a show for us a couple years earlier at his club in L.A., Power Tools. He was about to start a record label called Delicious Vinyl. Matt was with these two guys he was making music with who called themselves the Dust Brothers. They were playing a cassette of some instrumentals they were working on. Smooth and psychedelic and with layers of sound stacked on top of layers of sound. It was so nice and precise and funky to death. The music, the friends, the weird parties. I was really enjoying this new lifestyle I was living in Los Angeles. Sunny days are every day. There's always some kind of fragrant flower smell in the air at night. And it was just nice being away from the garbage truck filled New York for a minute. I also really liked these new people I was becoming friends with. I did feel like Rhoda Morgenstern most of the time I lived in Los Angeles, though. I knew I was out of place. I always kind of felt like schleppy. I guess being super stoned all the time added to the many conversations going on in my head. Thinking that the people around me were like, the Jewy New York guy is interesting, right? Why are his shirts always so dirty? But a big draw to sticking around out there was those amazing instrumentals the Dust Brothers played. I called Adam and Mike soon after I heard their music and suggested they come out to L.A. and meet these guys. Maybe potentially work on some music together. And so they did. And so we did. Made music with Matt and the Dust Brothers. At Matt Dyke's apartment. It was a big and long, sprawling apartment in a kind of Nowheresville neighborhood on the fringe of Hollywood. Rent was cheap back then, and you could find a place that had space for a couple of bedrooms and a makeshift recording studio in the living room. On each side of the long hallway of the apartment were all these doors painted by Jean-Michel Basquiat. Matt said that Jean-Michel used to come to L.A. and stay at his place, and some nights they'd drive around in Matt's big old pickup truck and look for stuff for Jean-Michel to paint on, stuff that people had thrown away, like discarded doors from construction dumpsters or something. Matt, to us, was a totally weirdly fascinating and interesting guy. It was similar to when I started to get to know Dono. We shared the same reference points, got the same dumb Barney Miller jokes, understood the different connotations between Adidas Countries and Shell Toes. We also believed that Chef Boyardee was of culinary icon status. For a couple of months, me, Adam, and Mike each rented a room in an expensive hotel, Le Mondrian, on Sunset Boulevard. Are you wasting your money when you're having an intense amount of fun spending that money? Tough call. But there we were, living that L.A. life. We had a bunch of new friends out there, and they'd all come by the hotel, and we'd get food and swim in the pool and stuff. It was young and wonderful. None of us had actual jobs, so we could really focus on what was important. Pot, snacks, mixtapes, going out to clubs, and, oh yeah, making new songs with Matt and the Dust Brothers. And that was 1988.
Expensive Shit by Michael Diamond. In Los Angeles, dense layers of infrastructure exist to rapidly separate you from your money. You can find and pay any number of people to locate a great vintage guitar you don't need, to sell or lease you cars and homes you can't afford, and extravagantly groom the dog that you don't even have. After the success of License to Ill, a bunch of people thought they knew exactly what our future should look like. After we parted ways with Def Jam, we started meeting with other labels and eventually signed with Capitol. In the music business of the late 1980s, fortunes could still be made, and Capitol was betting millions of dollars on us. They wanted a new record immediately. We were in less of a hurry. Matt Dyke introduced us to Mario Caldato, the engineer with whom he'd built a makeshift studio at Matt's down-and-out apartment on Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. They were recording instrumental tracks there with these two hip-hop fanatics named John King and Mike Simpson, who recorded under the name The Dust Brothers. We loved The Dust Brothers' shit the second we heard it, and immediately wanted to work with them on our next record. Their stuff had an entirely different vibe than the tracks on License to Ill. Funkier, jazzier, less classic rock, more R&B. It also pushed the boundaries of what we thought was possible with sample-based music. We started working together, and ended up recording most of the music and a fair number of vocals for Paul's Boutique at Matt's apartment. We really could have just recorded our entire album there, and in hindsight, I'm not exactly sure why we didn't. Capitol may have started to get nervous that we are holed up in a shitty apartment in the middle of a drug and prostitution zone, or maybe we were just insecure and thought that to make a big-time record, we had to do it at some big-time studio, with dudes with mullets crouched and poised to set up a mic or coil a cable. Or maybe we thought it was funny to record where Debbie Gibson and Lionel Richie might have recorded. Anyway, we ended up at the record plant. This place was the exact opposite of the Chung King House of Metal, not to mention Matt's apartment, an iconic L.A. studio. Platinum Eagles records lining the halls. Now don't get me wrong, the Eagles are a big name in the game, been in the game a long time, but what the fuck does that have to do with what we were making? So we booked time at the record plant and spent days just redoing the shit we'd already done at Matt's. We retracked every loop and scratch and redid our vocals, tweaked everything on the giant solid-state Logic mixing consoles that you see in every super fancy studio, ran tracks through expensive outboard gear with every variety of knobs, faders, lights, and meters in abundance. It was the same crew, the three of us. Mario C. on the faders, Mike and John behind desktop PCs. That's right, people. Laptops were not the go-to yet. Matt Dyke, rest in peace, kind of bobbing his head with a smile of approval every so often. And it took what seemed like forever. One day, while we were doing all this, a huge video crew rolled into the studio across the hall from us. Crass Services times 10. An army of dudes with rolls of tape hanging from their belts and walkie-talkies on their shoulders. Persian rugs were suddenly everywhere. Lots of booze bottles placed around the studio just so. Turned out, Guns N' Roses was there to film the video for Patience. First we ran into Slash briefly. Nice guy. Big hat. Then by the reception desk, we stumbled into the bass player, Duff McKagan. We started talking about hardcore, and it turned out he was in this band that we'd heard a lot on Noise the Show in our hardcore days, The Farts, a Seattle hardcore band. So here, we're meeting someone from a ginormous band, traveling around the world on floating magic carpets, their feet never touching the ground, and we realized we had more in common than we'd ever have thought. We never ran into Axel. Anyway, back to the recording of our album. After we got through a couple of songs, Shake Your Rump and Car Thief, we listened to what we'd done and realized, fuck, what we had from Matt's house was better. Yeah, some of the new vocals were stronger on the new versions, but overall, we were disappointed. We went more pro and lost some of the grit. This happens often when bands re-record their demos. They get a more polished recording, but lose some of the magical essence of the demo. Yeah, that's right, magical essence, people. So, did we cut our losses and go back to Matt's apartment? Nope, we did not. Instead, we doubled down on our bad idea by deciding to go record at some other really big LA studios on the off chance that they had some magical essence that the record plant was missing. We did some work at a studio where Quincy Jones had supposedly worked on those amazing albums he made with Michael Jackson. This spot had a crazy Harrison mixing console that looked like it belonged at NASA Mission Control. It was the first generation of digital console, a fucking humongous thing with all kinds of microgreen and red lights, the wave of the future. Unfortunately, at that time, the future still sucked. Nothing, and I mean nothing, worked on this thing. We'd sit around for hours while guys in button-down shirts ran in and out of the room in panic mode, unable to figure out why the entire studio was inoperable. After several days of doing nothing, bored out of our minds, we finally just canceled the session. So after all that, did we go back to Matt's apartment at last? No, we fucking did not. We decided to just return to the record plant, even though we didn't like what we'd already gotten there. We booked it for weeks on end to finish the record, tracking final vocals, scratches, overdubs, and mixing. It might have been a productive plan if we hadn't also decided to rent basically an entire arcade's worth of games and put them in the main room of the studio. We're talking full-on air hockey, pinball, etc. It's not like we needed room for an orchestra. It was just the three of us doing vocals in this huge room with a large staff to order us food and bring us coffee. We recorded ourselves playing ping pong in stereo so it could be panned left and right in the headphones. I guess it just made us feel big time. The upside was that we finally did finish Paul's Boutique in that second push at the record plant. The downside is that we wasted so much fucking money. I don't even know the exact amount, but it was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars fronted us by Capitol, which would come out of our royalties. It was even more of a fucking waste because we still liked many of the instrumental tracks from Matt's apartment best anyway. Soon enough, though, the amount of money we just wasted would be the least of our problems. Not long after Paul's Boutique came out, I ran into our old friend Dante Ross. He told me that he just heard our new record. He said, in a positive way, "Yo, I just heard your new record. It's all right. It's got, like, 2 songs on there." There's actually 15 songs on the track list, so I assumed that he meant that only 2 of those 15 were anything that anyone would want to listen to. We've used this quote about 1,000 times since. "Yo, you heard that new Radiohead joint? It's got like 1.5 songs on there." Shake Your Rump. All kinds of sampled funk bass lines and beats coming at ya in stereo at a super fast pace, and even a bong rip that we recorded at a fancy Hollywood studio. Yes, we'd paid handsome amounts of dollars to record a bong hit in a fancy studio where certainly many bong hits had come before, but maybe none of them were recorded? Also, the dude that says, "Is your name Michael Diamond?" was just a very tall messenger who happened to be delivering a cash advance to us at the studio. We would get so excited every time this would happen, even though it was our money, we would nickname the messengers Louie. Johnny Royale. Johnny Royale was a bum on our stoop. As in, Johnny Royale was a homeless guy we frequently found sitting or sleeping in front of our place on Barrow Street. This was at a time when grimy shit like that could happen in New York City, when cops and politicians let grimy shit like that happen. Many blocks had their regular homeless characters, who might disappear from time to time to go to various shelters or mental health spots or maybe jail, but would invariably return and be welcomed back by everyone on the block. Johnny was super weathered and leathery, but also looked like a 1950s rockabilly star, widow's peak and all that. We never got him to talk much about himself, but we'd heard that he was a forgotten early rock star whose extensive booze-filled adventures, in addition to getting screwed on royalties, had led him to our stoop. We eventually expanded the story into the lyrics for Johnny Royale. One day, when it was cold outside, I gave the real-life Johnny Royale my Def Jam satin jacket to stay warm. At some point, Russell saw him on the street and was super pissed. Mike D, why you give a Def Jam jacket to a bum? I don't want motherfuckers seeing that. He didn't think Johnny was the best brand ambassador, but we did. 5-piece chicken dinner. You know what? I'm proud of this cut. Not because we spent so long making it, weaving in intricate ideas, or because we spent days on lyrics. There are none. It's just that this idea is so damn stupid and juvenile, and we did it. And it's super short and kind of great and starts off side 2 of the vinyl version. So there.
Shadrach. Allegedly, a very long time ago, there were these 3 Jewish dudes who would not bow down to a golden idol in the image of Nebuchadnezzar, the new king of Babylon. He was super pissed, and a lot of people got jealous of the 3 dudes, so the king threw them into a fiery furnace. They were like, fuck it, go ahead and throw us into a fiery furnace. God will make this right. We don't care about you and your bullshitty golden statue, and besides, we prefer the warm weather anyways. When the king looked upon them in the fire, he saw that they were not only still alive, but they were singing songs, and a 4th band member had joined them amongst the flames. None other than Jesus Christ himself. The king, being a total starfucker, was like, get those dudes out of the fiery furnace. Hashtag Nebuchadnezzar. Hashtag sad. Hashtag failing empire.
B-boy Booyabaze. We wanted to make our own psychedelic rap manifesto inspired by listening to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, and Hendrix super loud in various automobiles and Yauch's bedroom. We had 9 song ideas left over. We could have spent time working on them and developing them more fully, but instead we decided to shove them all together into 1 medley and call it a Booyabaze. One of these ideas featured Yauch's vocals recorded at his apartment using a military helmet with a microphone built in that he bought at a thrift store. A year and a day. Also, coming from hardcore, we always loved the economy of super short songs. Please listen to I Like Food by the Descendants. So what if we tried some rap songs like that? Zen Schoen for good measure, a completely crazy 808 beat that Yauch recorded onto an 8-track in his kitchen, AWOL, backward loops, fuzz bass, b-boy routines, and 100 New York City shoutouts, then chop up and mix and cut it all together with a Ginsu 2.
Barrel-Chested Randy by Michael Diamond, read by Crosby Fitzgerald, as Buckhead Betty. Growing up in New York City, none of us had a car. None of us needed a car. We took the subway. We walked. Sometimes, if we had extra cash, we piled into taxis. When we started hanging out with Run and them, they lived in Queens. It was B-boy to drive a car. A whip. Whatever. In certain areas, like the Hollis that Run DMC came from, the Brooklyn where Eric B and Rakim came from, or the Roosevelt Long Island where Public Enemy came from, only drug dealers, pimps, celebrity reverends, and crooked politicians drove nice cars.
You seem to have detailed knowledge about things that only drug dealers have, Michael.
On Sucker MC's, when Run rhymed, "Now Larry put me inside his Cadillac," that was some vivid and real shit.
Larry refers to Larry Smith, hip-hop producer extraordinaire who produced the first few Run DMC albums, Curtis Blow, etc. When his records started becoming hits, Larry bought a Cadillac real quick.
As soon as Run DMC made some money, DMC got a Cadillac, Jam Master Jay got a Jeep Wrangler, and Run had his BMW 3 Series. After Russell signed Eric B. and Rakim, Eric B. wowed us all by spending a sizable amount of his advance money on a used burgundy 4-door Rolls Royce. I mean, this was some Thurston Howell III type shit. It seemed way out of our reach. As soon as we started spending time in L.A., though, we followed suit. We had a manager at the time named Andy Slater, and he introduced us to this guy, Randy. Randy wore glasses, was always well-groomed. He had a big barrel chest and wore tight polo shirts tucked into even tighter pants. He was one of those guys who repeated his spiel over and over every single time he talked to you, as if he'd never said it before. "I'm going to get you into the right car at the right price." Randy would always be talking about what cars he was handling for whom. Inevitably, any conversations about your car would segue into a discussion about what Randy was doing for Kenny Rogers or Lionel Richie, how fabulous they were and how even more fabulous their cars were. This was Hollywood 101. You're only as successful as your clientele. Say what you will about Randy's spiel, though, he meant that shit. He could get you anything. Some old muscle car? Check. A brand new Range Rover? Done. Vintage Cadillac? You got it. And he'd get you any kind of accessories you wanted. The booming system, the interiors, the ginormous car phone. And yeah, we could have just gone to a Range Rover dealership, but remember, A, this whole buying a car thing was completely new and foreign to us. B, we looked like, acted like, and were still teenagers, basically, so some slick dude at a luxury car dealership in Beverly Hills with a mustache and aviator glasses was not looking to spend time showing us around anything. And C, we had to customize that shit. Booming system, phone, car fax machine, etc. Yeah, that's right, a fax machine, so I could write a rhyme about getting a fax in a car and then fax it to you. We definitely didn't know where to start with that, but Randy had an endless list of suppliers who would gladly help lighten our pockets. We were kids in a candy store. We'd sit in the studio with Randy, stoned, looking at pictures of cars and talking about them. Of course, this service came at a very steep price. One that was frankly out of our league, though we didn't realize it at the time. Adam Horovitz went with a beautiful dark green Range Rover. Very B-boy, but elegant at the same time. He also added some crazy subwoofers in the back. I don't think there is much trunk left, but he had a shit ton of bass. Only problem was, this thing was a lemon and had to go into the shop all the time. I opted for a crazy muscle car, a 1968 Plymouth GTX with a 440 engine, red with white decal stripes. I kind of pimped out the interior, adding B-boy burgundy pipe into the white seats and putting in a crazy sound system that, when it worked and if you're properly stoned, was pretty transcendent. We also built a custom box between the two front seats for the massive car phone. The car would have been great had I possessed any mechanical know-how whatsoever. I did not. It constantly required tinkering with the carburetor, fuel lines, hoses, and spark plugs so it would run right, or actually run at all. I had to call AAA so many times I started to wish they had frequent flyer miles. Though, I probably didn't help my own cause by putting a sound system appropriate for a nightclub in a car from the 1960s with an AM radio. Yauch won the prize for most esoteric and least practical choice. An early 70s black Cadillac Fleetwood Brougham d'Elegance. Best name ever. This thing was basically a limo. A ride for a 70s diplomat or maybe a studio chief. An early 70s Maybach, if you will.
The backseat area of Yauch's car was wild. All burgundy pleather with secret flip-up bucket seats that faced backward. When the seats were folded down, it was like a plush-carpeted, sleazy mosh pit.
It was huge and thoroughly impractical to park, but it was incredible to cruise in. It also rode really low to the ground, so any bumps or dips would make it bottom out and scrape the ground. Yauch put in an incredible sound system that featured a DAT player, which was completely unheard of at the time.
DAT stood for Digital Audio Tape. It was the next step in the evolution of the cassette, a smaller tape and a huge step up sonically. You could record your own music and not have the hiss and loss you got on cassettes.
We would drive around, blasting dats of stuff we were working on or mixes of music, and just drive and pretty much have the best time ever. Bought for us at a markup by our new friend Randy.
It All Started at Dolly Parton's Birthday Party by Adam Horovitz. Read by Tim Meadows. At some point in 1988, me, Adam, and Mike had decided that since we were together pretty much all day and night already, we might as well rent a big house and just do it up family style. Enter the G-Spot. It was a crazy house off Mulholland Drive, just down the street from the spaceship-looking house from the movie Body Double. There was a gate at the entrance of the house with a big G on it, hence the name. You'd go through the gate and you'd drive down this little driveway, and straight ahead where you parked, you could see right into the house, right into this crazy entryway with a rock wall, a bunch of fake plants, and a pool table. Outside the house was a swimming pool with a little bridge that went over it. It was butter on a roll at a shitty spaghetti place. The best. The interior decoration scheme was like the restaurant that the cast of Quincy hung out at. or the Regal Beagle from Three's Company. The house had a burgundy vinyl restaurant-style booth for dining at and an old-time lamppost in the living room. You know, just 'cause.
It was adorned with nude statuary that involved the feeding of grapes.
We fucking loved it and made ourselves right at home. We each picked our own room. Mike's was the master bedroom suite upstairs, the one with the view and the huge bathtub. Yalk's was the media center slash library room. It had a massive 80s television and oversized reclining leather bad boy chairs and couches. My room was the pool house, separate from the main house. It was right on the side of the mountain. It had a bar in it, and there was a window that looked right into the bottom of the pool. So fucking great. The inside sleeve picture from Paul's boutique was taken from inside that bedroom. Some nights I'd fall asleep to the sounds of wild animals. Ones we didn't have in Manhattan. Deer, raccoon, coyote, fucking bobcats. And some mornings I'd wake up hearing loud banging. I'd look up and I'd see Yalk fully clothed in the swimming pool, harassing me through the little pool window, trying to get me to wake up so that we could do nothing. The owners of the G-Spot were an older couple named Alex and Madeline Grasshoff. In one of the bedrooms, there was an illustration of a few people surrounding a movie camera that said Grasshopper Unit on it. We were curious about this, and so we did some research on the Grasshoffs by going through most of their personal stuff inside the house. We discovered that Alex was a TV director and had made this massively popular after-school special in the early 80s called The Wave. Damn, the G-Spot jumped up to another level. The house with a fucking lamppost in the kitchen and all the crazy 70s trimmings is owned by the dude who made The Wave. And homie's got a unit? The Grasshopper Unit. If you can picture the movie character Dolomite in 1975, having a meeting with contractors and architects, sitting down to discuss building his dream home, the G-Spot would be it. The main thing about our rental home, though, was this. In the room Mike was staying in, there was a locked closet. And when you're mostly stoned and really have nothing to do all day, you get curious. So we broke into the closet. Inside was what we assumed to be Madeline's wardrobe. A fucking barrage of crazy shit from the 70s. Like, if you would have said that Sly and the Family Stone wore this stuff on There's a Riot Going On tour in 1972, we would have been like, oh, shit. So, of course, we started wearing Madeline's clothes around the house, often. She had, like, long ankle-length brown leather coats, fur items, straw shower cap things, so many signature pieces. Then we started to wear them out, on the town, that is. And that brings us to Dolly Parton's birthday party. What had happened was we got invited to the big-time music manager Sandy Gallen's house to celebrate Dolly Parton's birthday. And what do you do when you get invited to Dolly Parton's birthday party? You fucking go to that shit psyched as hell.
Prior to Dolly Parton's gala birthday event, and after our fallout with Russell Simmons, we met with Sandy Gallen to see if, potentially, he would be our manager. He was the manager for people like Dolly Parton, Michael Jackson, Cher, Barbra Streisand. So why not us, right? The meeting took place one afternoon at Mr. Gallen's big, crazy, awesome house in Beverly Hills. The sun was out, birds were chirping. Dude had a big, crazy landscaped lawn. A koi pond with a walking path that led you right to the big front door. Me, Adam, and Mike were feeling a little out of our league slash element. Three schleps from New York in this lush environment. We rang the bell and waited. The door opened and it's Sandy Gallen in just his tighty-whitey Fruit of the Loom underpants. Okay. We said our hellos and introductions and he led us through the big foyer into a huge living room and he said, I'll be right back. And soon he returned in a white terry cloth robe. He sat on the couch, and we had our meeting. As they say in Hollywood, we weren't the right match. But that shit was super big-time Hollywood, and kind of fucking gangster.
So, day of, we're at the G-Spot, and we're getting pumped and prepped for Dolly's party. While trying on various ensembles, we were like, yo, we are for sure wearing the most fucked-up outfits to the party tonight, right? Yes. We split up for whatever reason, and me and Yauk said to Mike and his girlfriend and future wife, Tamara, see you at the party tonight. Then, before me and Yauk left, we decided that there was no way we were wearing this stuff tonight. This party's going to be awkward enough already, but we did not convey that decision to Mike and Tamara. Hey, it was pre-cell phone. I'm sure we tried. Me and Yauk get to the party, and there's Mike. Now, I don't remember the exact outfit he had on, but it was something like this. Satin or velvet pants, ankle-length patchwork leather coat, no shirt, and a huge white fur hat. Tamara was basically in the same outfit.
Actually, it was a green leisure suit type deal. Not just green, but super bright lime green, something you could spot from hundreds of yards away, a matching jacket and super wide flared bell-bottom pants. And to top this look off literally, I had on a white fur hat, kind of like Sly Stone meets your grandma style.
Now remember, this was before any kind of 70s throwback slash Austin Powers slash D-Light-esque scenario. So Mike and Tamara just looked like crazy, perhaps homeless people at the super fancy Hollywood party for Dolly fucking Parton. In retrospect, it's funny, but to Mike and Tammy in that moment, maybe not so much.
Interestingly, it was still somehow close enough to the 70s that people really got uncomfortable for a minute seeing this kind of throwback commitment. The party's attendees were definitely older than us and had actually worn these clothes in the 1970s. At this particular point in time, people were not checking that era for fashion cues.
But there we were hanging out at the party, you know, us, Kenny Rogers, Barbara Streisand, and people of that stature, ilk, and genre. We saw Bob Dylan there. Mike's a huge Dylan fan, and I don't know what he was thinking, but he went right over to talk to him. He's like, "Hi, I'm Mike. I'm in a band called Beastie Boys," and Dylan doesn't flinch at his crazy outfit, but he asked the age-old question, "How many are you good for?"
What?
Bob Dylan is seated on the arm of a sofa with his back turned to a small group of people that are still in conversation with him. "Tickets, man. How many are you good for?"
"You mean, like, how many people come to see us play?"
"Mm-hmm."
"I don't know, man. Like a few hundred, maybe? Sometimes maybe a few thousand? I don't even really know."
"Good. I'm putting together a pro-smoking concert, and I'm trying to get people involved."
"Oh, wow. Huh. So pro-smoking, like cigarettes? Benefit concert?"
Now, very aware of his outfit and out of placeness in this adult Hollywood party, Mike sort of mumbles some other words as he slowly backs away from Bob Dylan, retreating to the comfort of his friends. End of scene. Mike came back to me, Yauk, and Tammy and reported what just happened. Like, where do you go from there? When you get outweirded by Bob Dylan, what do you do next? Walk away, I guess. We snooped around the house for a bit looking for Dolly Parton, but we never saw her, so we split. On our way out, though, we walked by someone playing this amazing grand piano, and Mike said, "Oh, shit, that's Burt fucking Bacharach." "Oh, shit. That is Burt fucking Bacharach. Hollywood is awesome." This night marked a new future for us. We were now part of the fucking Grasshopper unit. What?
The Business of Paul's Boutique by Adam Horovitz. Read by John C. Reilly. It's not like we wanted to burn the fucking flag or anything. We just wanted a huge American flag that said Beastie Boys on it, flown on the roof of the Capitol Records building. And when Paul's Boutique was done, finished, and handed in to Capitol, that flag was raised for all of Los Angeles to see. We had a big record release party up on the roof of the building, Hollywood's own Empire State Building. The party coincided with George Bush's campaign to protect the American flag from desecration. We weren't trying to burn it or anything. We were the multi-platinum Fight for Your Right to Party guys. We were just really feeling ourselves. And we wanted the world to know. Like, this was Frank Sinatra's building, but now it's ours. We truly believed that we were shot callers. It's like when Tamara Davis was going to direct a video for Cher. The first day of the shoot, Cher walks right up to Tammy D, introduces herself, and says, "I'm going to be wearing leather. A lot of leather. Get used to it." And that's when things started to get a little odd. Right after we handed in the final version of Paul's Boutique, the president of Capitol Records quit. Around the same time, the A&R guy who brought us in and signed us quit. New faces at the label. New band on the label. Then this happened. Capitol brought us in for a marketing meeting to launch the record. They had to sit down with their street team to figure out how to get the word out to the streets. Yikes. The street team had a plan. They had been given the title Street Awareness Program. And so on their presentation paperwork, it spelled out SAP in big letters across the top of each page. Already funny. SAP, SAP, SAP. Their marketing plan was for us to make a diss record against MC Hammer. They said that diss records always get some kind of attention, and because Hammer was so huge, that'd be great. Oh, and that because Hammer was also on Capitol Records, it'd be easy to contact him to let him know that it wasn't for real. We told the Saps that we'd never met Hammer and had nothing against him, and that he seemed like a nice enough guy. Maybe we should just try to get the songs in the radio and in the clubs and stuff instead. To be fair, me, Adam, and Mike were sitting in that meeting obviously high as kites and dressed in our best Madeline Grasshoff outfits, looking like we were on our way to a Simande concert. I'm sure the lack of confidence was mutual. But the most weirdest and most bummerish thing happened after the record came out. We just assumed that because License to Ill sold a billion copies, Paul's Boutique would do the same. But, like, it didn't. I went to the Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard a couple days after it came out, and they didn't have any copies. So I thought, great, this shit is flying off the shelves and we are still large. It turned out that they did sell out quick, but Capitol had only sent, like, I don't know, 100 or so copies. No back order, nothing. Seriously, Capitol is literally down the street from Tower Records. Can't someone drive a couple boxes over? I mean, shit, I'll buy the goddamn stamps. We don't know who we were supposed to call to be like, you know, there's no copies at Tower Records. Or, is there a better game plan than us humiliating ourselves by making a record trying to pick a fight with MC Hammer? So we were in kind of a holding pattern. Kept trying to arrange a meeting with the new president of Capitol Records, but he wasn't really getting back to us. A solid couple weeks go by, and then we finally meet with him. We go to the top floor of the Capitol Records building and wait on some nice new couches. The president is ready for us, so we go in. The first thing I notice is, man, this is a nice office. It's kind of huge and has a crazy view. You can see all of what LA is made of. But the most striking visual inside the room is the new president himself. My man is like mid-50s, balding on top with a teeny ponytail on the back, and he's rocking a brand new crispy fake tie-dyed Grateful Dead tour t-shirt. Yeesh. So we sit down, and before we can ask our what's and why's, he's like, "Look, guys, I'm a deadhead, so I know where you're at. The company's just really busy right now. We're all just focusing and working really hard on the new Donny Osmond album, so next time, okay?" Wait, what? What he had just said to us, the multi-platinum fight for your right to party guys, is forget about the record you just spent the past couple years making. Forget that you made a huge and bold move severing ties with Rick Russell, Rush, and Def Jam. Forget all this life-changing shit that's happening to you as a band, people, and friends. Because Donny Osmond's new record is just a little more important than yours. Just go back, make another record, and we'll see what happens when that happens. Everything's going to be fine. Industry rule number 4080. Record company people are shady. The teeny ponytailed phony baloney hippie costume looking like an undercover cop guy was replaced soon after by some other middle-aged white guy record executive. To quote the great Donny Osmond, "One bad apple don't spoil the whole bunch, girl." Important note. Besides this glitch, Capitol Records has always been really supportive of us and what we make. I'm not talking shit on the label because really, for a major label with a big business to run, they left us alone to make what we wanted to make, and we probably couldn't have done that somewhere else. That being said, for a good time, look up Donny Osmond Sacred Emotion on YouTube. That's what this deadhead had the company locked down with.
Soul Train by Adam Horovitz. No one you know has been on Soul Train, right? Well, I just want to say how fucking cool it was that we got to be on Soul Train. And not once, but twice. The first time was in 87 to promote License to Ill. And like most things at that time, it went by in a blur. Everything felt unreal. All of a sudden being a big band, not being the opener, but the headliner. And now we're on TV. Fucking American Bandstand, Soul Train, the Joan Rivers Show. Yes, the Joan Rivers Show. Out of all of the talk shows we've ever done, Joan Rivers was the best. She came to our little dressing room before the show to meet us. We could hear her coming down the hall screaming, "Who's from Brooklyn?" She was awesome and hilarious and really nice to us. So there. But Soul Train? Being on Soul Train was like being on Bugs Bunny. That show was so embedded into our fabric, our DNA. It was unreal to go from being 7 years old, lying on the couch eating fucking Entenmann's pound cake, watching Soul Train, to us being on that stage, with those dancers, with none other than Don the Don Cornelius. Mind-blowing. If I could have told my fifth-grade class that I was going to be on Soul Train twice, I would have had baller status at PS41 for sure. Even Mr. Goldstein would have been like, "Oh, shit!" The second time we were booked on the show in 89, we made sure that shit was tight. I'm sorry to spoil this for you, but no one actually performed their music on Soul Train, or American Bandstand, or almost any of those old shows. Have you ever been on stage and had to lip sync, but do it like you want people to believe that you're actually singing and playing? Well, it for sure makes you feel like a doofus, and it's kind of mortifying. That's why we fucked around so much. So, before we went to do Soul Train the second time, we recorded a new live version of the song that we were going to perform. We figured at least it'd be different. And if we added some call and response, it'd be funny, and maybe someone in the know, watching, would think, "Wait, are they actually doing this song live right now?" So we're up there, doing the song, cameras are rolling, dancers are dancing, and we came to the part where we had recorded, "Somebody say Don! Don! Cornelius! Cornelius!" My friend Donna was there watching Don Cornelius watching the little TV monitor off to the side of the stage. And when Cornelius heard his own name, he got super confused, looking at the monitor, then the stage, then the monitor, then the stage. For a moment, he thought, "Are they actually doing this song live right now?" When the song ended, he comes out on stage to plug our new record that's available in the marketplace and to say thanks for being here and all of that other TV show host stuff. The same thing he'd done with James Brown, the Commodores, Roberta Flack, etc. But now it's us. You tell me how you would feel if that was you being greeted by Don Cornelius on the actual Soul Train stage. Unreal, right? Anyways, Don Cornelius hesitantly walks out on stage towards us. Camera still rolling, but he seems weirded out by us. Me and Mike had brought copies of Ronco's Soul Train Greatest Hits record with us. We asked him to autograph them for us right there on the air. He probably thought we were fucking with him. He was used to having legends on his stage, not three scrubs potentially trying to clown him. But really, we weren't.
G-Sun by Michael Diamond. When I accidentally slammed a rental car into the gate outside the Grasshouse house, I wanted to avoid calling the landlord. Better to just quietly have it repaired ourselves. Mario Caldado, the engineer on Paul's Boutique, who is now part of our regular crew, recommended his old friend Mark. He's great with this stuff. He'll fix it, no problem. Mark's full name was Mark Ramos Nishida, and he was great. Fixed the gate perfectly, and talked to us a lot about music. Next time we saw Mario, we were all kind of like, "This guy's awesome. What's the deal with him?" Come to find out, Mario and Mark had grown up together and played in a bunch of the same bands. Mark apparently could play anything, was an especially good keyboard player, and had all kinds of great music gear. But more important for our immediate needs, he was an excellent carpenter. It had been pretty heartbreaking when Paul's Boutique didn't work. So we did what we do best. Just hung out. Got breakfast, got stoned, got some records, listened to records, talked about what parts of what records are amazing,
drove around, made mixtapes, listened to mixtapes, sampled some music, programmed some beats. What I'm trying to say is, we would absolutely and completely obsess over records. Then, eventually, we got around to talking about making a new record. We've been super inspired by a bunch of the soul, funk, and jazz records we were buying and sampling. We also felt that we'd push sample-based songs as far as they could go on Paul's Boutique. Plus, that shit was getting mad expensive, so the idea for our next record became, let's go in the opposite direction. Instead of sampling records, we'll play the music, like on instruments, ourselves. Music that was influenced by those records we've been buying and that sounded like them, using that exact sort of instrumentation. Yeah, we never trained as musicians, but we're going to play like the music we sample, even though that music was played by guys who spent decades learning jazz. You might say it was stoned, arrogant, or straight up crazy, but you can't say it wasn't ambitious. This was all possible because nobody at Capitol wanted anything to do with us. The new people were like, I just got this new job. I don't want to get fired. I ain't messing with that. You do it. Like a bunch of kids in a schoolyard looking at a dead bird, their lack of interest gave us free rein to do whatever we wanted. We were on paid vacation. By then, we'd moved out of the G-spot, the Grassoff house, and each gotten our own place. So we set up our instruments in Horowitz's West Hollywood apartment, me on drums, Yauch on bass, Horowitz on guitar. Mario helped us set everything up and was there all the time, recording everything using these weird, flat, low-tech but cool-sounding PZM microphones bought at Radio Shack. Mario was very much on the same page as us and understood what we wanted to achieve, even if on some days that just meant smoking pot and listening to Lee Scratch Perry. Pretty quickly, we realized we needed a keyboard player to pull off the sound we were after, someone who could play the Wurlitzer, the organ, the Moog, and a clavinet, like on the funky records we've been devouring by Jimmy Smith, Stevie Wonder, Groove Holmes, etc. That's when it occurred to us, Mark Nishida, a.k.a. Keyboard Money Mark, the guy who repaired the gate. We brought him in, and he was even better than Mario had led us to believe. The five of us began to play regularly until one day when Adam was leaving his apartment and ran into his downstairs neighbor, who told him that A, he'd been cleaning all his guns and couldn't wait to use them, and B, some loud music from upstairs had been seriously disturbing him. We needed to find a studio. Next stop was Cole, a clean but thoroughly unglamorous Hollywood rehearsal space that we'd booked by the hour. Again, Mario would set up the Radio Shack mics, and we would set up our instruments, smoke some weed, play, record to dat, and hope for the best. Thing was, we would do this for a few hours, and would then have to break it all down so the next group could come in. Most definitely a drag. We'd learned our lesson after Paul's Boutique. We now wanted a super cheap space that we could take over indefinitely. Leave our shit there. Try any crazy idea we had, with the room to fail, and without the running meter, pressure, and cost of a big L.A. studio. We looked at some places in downtown L.A., but at the time, DTLA still had too much of a Night of the Living Dead vibe. This was at the height of the crack epidemic. Then, a musician friend told me about this no-name studio in Atwater Village where he just worked. The owner was a musician who worked out of the studio, but things seemed really slow, so maybe we could work something out with him. In 1990, Atwater was a sleepy little neighborhood just over the L.A. River from Silver Lake. It had a main shopping strip with a small-town USA vibe and not much else. The studio was in a building on that main strip, above a drugstore. The place didn't look like much from the outside, but inside, it was perfect. The main room was a big, open ballroom. I think it used to be some kind of Rotary Club or Lions Club or something, with a parquet floor and a high, round ceiling. Tony Ripperetti ran it. Very nice guy. Had a minor hit in the early 80s as a member of the L.A. band Sue Sad and the Next. Was now doing film scores out of the studio. Mostly cyborg and slasher-type stuff. Another guy had a room there. Country Mike. He too had a couple of minor hits in his past. Seemed like he'd been through a lot. His room smelled of cheap weed and bad wine. Empty wine bottles on the floor. He had this routine of coming in and writing one song a night. He'd ride the bus over from Angelino Heights as a way to find inspiration in the faces and conversations of the other commuters. He'd come in, brew a big pot of coffee, and get to work. He may or may not have been slightly intoxicated by the end of the day, but he'd have a new song. We took the place immediately. Tony had his two rooms, Country Mike kept his, and we took the big ballroom. To make a separate control room, we decided to tear up and combine two adjoining closets. Then we need to build out that control room and get the main room right. And by get the main room right, I mean we had to build a skate ramp and install a basketball hoop in there. And also extend the stage a bit so we could leave all our instruments set up. It was crucial to have everything ready to go at all times, so whatever dumb idea one of us came up with, we could play and record it immediately. We lacked the discipline to sit on an idea while equipment got set up. We'd never remember it, so it was paramount that we could record pretty much anything right away. Pre-internet, finding used instruments and vintage studio gear was a real pain in the ass. You could go to music shops, but that entailed a day of listening to some guitar noodling, mullet-sporting owner hold forth on whatever topics struck his fancy until he decided whether or not to sell you the thing that he knew you really wanted. In L.A. circa 1990, the gold mine for used gear was this weekly, small-sized newspaper called The Recycler. Basically, all it contained was pages and pages of classified ads. The key to getting anything good or underpriced was being the first person to call about something, so you had to buy The Recycler right when it came out every week. We outfitted our entire studio with gear we found via The Recycler. The timing was perfect for buying the type of vintage instruments we wanted. They were considered obsolete by pros and hadn't yet been adopted by collectors. Pros at that time wanted brand new keyboards that had clavinet and Wurlitzer and organ sounds all built in with digital technology, so they all wanted to get rid of their Hohner D6 clavinets or their Mini Moogs, or their Rhodes 88s. You'd get that stuff ridiculously cheap. The weirdest part was when you'd go deep into the valley to pick up a piece of gear at a stranger's house. It would give you uncomfortable insight into their whole life story. Pretty much every purchase for us was a result of some other guy having to give up his dream. It definitely added a tinge of bittersweet to our otherwise good fortune. After a few months of work, we finally got our new studio up and running. There was an old sign on the roof that originally said Gelson Plumbing, but all that was left was an aging G, then a few spaces, and then Sun. So we named the studio G-Sun, G-Sun with the parquet floor. Now all we needed to do was make another record.
Hippie Steve by Adam Horovitz. Of all the people who've come and gone in our friendship circle, Hippie Steve is one of my favorites. He was our L.A. pot dealer in the late 80s, early 90s. He's a really nice dude, it's just he was comically hippie. He really looked like an undercover cop. He drove a nice car and always wore new tie-dyed shirts and billowy hippie hammer pants. It's tough to trust a well-groomed and clean hippie wearing expensive hippie clothes. My brother Matthew lived in L.A. in the early 90s, and one day he drove out to Hippie Steve's place in Brentwood to buy some weed. He said that Steve lived in an apartment above the garage of his parents' expensive house. The whole time he was there, Steve kept complaining about how his square parents just didn't get it, how they were part of the man's corrupt corporate capitalist society. Meanwhile, my brother's just trying to get weed, get out of this weird super rich people neighborhood, and get back to his crappy apartment so he and his roommate could get high and listen to Smith's records. I'm certainly not into hippies at all, but I do prefer my hippies dirty, shoeless, and stealing shit from my apartment. Hippie Steve was like a white-collar hippie, a hippie with a hustle. We bought a fucking ton of pot from him throughout the years. It was such a regular occurrence that we wouldn't give him cash. He would just make weekly trips to our business office and pick up a check. Don't all big-time L.A. rock stars have their drug dealers go to their business office? I very much doubt that Slash made his pot dealer wait in the car while he ran into the bank to get cash, or gave him a personal check signed Slash, paid to the order of Hippie Steve. 4. Money for pot. We spent a lot of time with Steve, as one does with one's pot dealer. He'd come to the studio and hang out. He'd come by the house. He and Yauch went on a few snowboard excursions together. He knew a lot about music and music gear, and so we did have plenty to talk about. It's just, as a punk rocker, I was trained for disdain when it came to hippies. But something about Steve was different. It almost felt as if he was a method actor studying for the role of hippie. I always had this idea of Steve only being a hippie when he sold pot, like he'd strap on the Tevas, dead shirt, and hemp cargo shorts when he was leaving the house with different strains of weed and hash oils. And when he sold cocaine, he probably wore a nice Armani-ish suit, had a gun, and went to discos. And he'd wear super tight ripped black jeans and a Pantera t-shirt, tease up his hair, and head to the Ralph's supermarket on Sunset to sell heroin. But I'm pretty sure he's always been a nice, harmless, upper-middle-class dude trying to make a buck selling pot, who just wants to jam out and play didgeridoo all day with his friend that makes didgeridoos.
L.A. Gear by Michael Diamond, read by John C. Reilly. After we'd lived in L.A. for a while, we got obsessed with a certain type of work gear that we'd seen people sporting around town. The gear was mostly Carhartt and Ben Davis. I knew Carhartt as the construction standard from back east, but Ben Davis was a below-the-radar regional brand, family-made, simple, stayed creased with ease, and only available on the West Coast. Best of all, their emblem had a monkey on it. Trouble was, the only places you could find this stuff were Army-Navy stores in wayward industrial areas of greater L.A. The trips were generally worthwhile, but it would end up taking an hour each way for us if you didn't hit traffic. Around that time, I was always at the Silver Lake Dog Park with my girlfriend and future wife, Tamara.
Yep, that's right. I just admitted I was, like, always at the dog park, fool. I guess if you break it down, we are young urban creators with dogs. Yep, so with pups. Oh, what?
We became friends with a crew of regulars there. Among them, these two RISD grads, Adam Silverman and Eli Bonners. One day, I was telling Adam and Eli about the lengths I'd have to go to get the work gear I was sporting, and a light bulb just kind of went off. What if there was a spot in our neighborhood that carried all this stuff? I asked them, and then promptly went back to scooping my dog's shit. At this point in my life, I must have had, I don't know, 5,000 great ideas like this, and invariably the idea I was excited about would either be forgotten, or if it was a genuinely good idea, ignored until someone else did it. But Eli and Adam got off their asses and made this shit happen. They found a small storefront on an up-and-coming stretch of Vermont Avenue in the Los Feliz neighborhood of Northeast L.A., adjacent to Hollywood and Silver Lake. At the time, it wasn't high rent at all. Once they got the space, me and a few other folks put in a modest amount of money, and within weeks, we opened up shop. That was the first extra-large store. At first, the stock was limited to Ben Davis, Carhartt, some extra-large t-shirts, and dead-stock sneakers. We'd search sporting goods and shoe stores everywhere, looking on high shelves for dusty abandoned boxes of Puma Clydes, Adidas shell toes, and so on. We were so into it that we had a guy named Concave Dave who scoured the Tacoma and Seattle area. Pretty quickly, we got bored with the small amount of other designers' clothes we actually liked, and just started making more and more clothes ourselves, sweatshirts, button-down flannels, jackets, jeans. Eli and his brother Eric churned out designs on their computer. Before we knew it, Extra Large was shipping to Japan and worldwide, and this was an actual business. Not that you would have known it from walking into the shop. A daily crew of skater kids, quote, worked there, which mostly entailed them doing bong rips in a loft at the back of the store. It was a funny crew. Jason Lee was around a lot. He was mostly still just a skater then. Spike Jones would stop by almost daily. Once in a while, a random Japanese film crew would show up, talking about what these crazy kids are doing in L.A. Eventually, a design studio and warehouse were set up around the corner from G-Sun in Atwater, and Extra Large became a fairly legit international streetwear brand. Stores opened in Tokyo, Osaka, New York, Taipei. There was a groundswell of new DIY clothing brands in L.A. that were started out of parents' garages, studio apartments, and crap dorm rooms. You had brands like Fucked and Jive, and skateboard companies like Supreme and Girl. And all of it crossed over with the L.A. hip-hop scene. Cypress Hill was definitely associated with Carhartt jackets and beanies. N.W.A. with oversized white t-shirts, Dickies, and L.A. Raiders caps. It seems like so long ago now. Because present-day hip-hop has become all about big-name fashion, Tom Ford and Gucci and Rolexes, and rappers sitting front and center along the runways at Fashion Week, pulling up in their new Bugattis and touting their new capsule collections and $1,000 signature sneakers. The original impulses behind b-boy and skater fashion, imagination, daring, and swagger, were all done with little or no money. which is exactly the way it should be.
Yo, Paul, this is Alan, by Adam Horowitz, read by Bette Midler.